Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this month's podcast. Very pleased to be joined by David Hart from Service Max. David, hello.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to kick off by actually having a look at your career, David, because it's quite an interesting progression that you've made through. I know you've been in the industry for about 30 years. Perhaps you could talk us through how you've progressed throughout your career.
Yeah, indeed, man and boy. Yeah, I guess when I left technical college in 83, I joined a Canon dealer, actually, working on Canon's photocopy equipment.
Okay.
And I did that for about 4 years, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and then found an opportunity within a Dutch company called Ose, who were a manufacturer of printers and photocopies and so on. So I started as a service engineer, did that for about 5 or 6 years, realized you're never going to get rich getting your hands dirty, so I thought I'd try that management lark, as they say,
yeah.
run a few successful projects for them. Was very heavily involved in a big project at BNFL Sellafield, where we installed about 160 machines.
Right.
And then ran a big project within their BAE Systems, where we had to install 1,000 machines in 10 weeks. So I really enjoyed that as well.
Yeah.
And after that, got promoted into running a small team of initially 9 engineers, and that grew to sort of 30 guys. So yeah, had a great time. And then they asked me to open their service department for them in the Republic of Ireland, which was a great opportunity. I went over there for a couple of years, took the family with me. But after that, I was kind of running out of things to do there. So I looked around and saw an opportunity to join Pitney Bowes in 1990. I joined their facilities management division first. And that gave me my first exposure to running a profit center. You know, I ran over 30 contracts with full P&L responsibility and learned a lot of valuable lessons. And then I did that for about 2 or 3 years and looked internally within the organization. And there was an opportunity for the UK service director role, which I really wanted to get into because obviously back into full service.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I did that. 150 people, managed 150 people there, which was great. And I got promoted then into the director of DMT business. That's the very, very high-speed printers, inserters, and sortation equipment. Very challenging role, but really enjoyable. That took me up to 500 people and about an 80 million budget. And then my last role within Pitney Bowes before joining ServiceMax, I became the vice president of European service. So, you know, about 1,000 people and a 200 million budget. So, yeah, off the tools and through the management chain. So I learned a lot along the way.
Oh, fantastic. And it's always interesting and good to see somebody kind of making the natural progressions and doing it exceptionally well, may I say. Do you think that's given you the insight, you know, coming from that service engineer background, do you think that's kind of given you the better insight into how to manage your teams as a service manager, service director, VP?
Mm-hmm. Good question. I guess you have to ask my old team that, but I hope so. I guess ultimately I understand what makes engineers tick, if that's the right word. I guess I know what motivates them, indeed what frustrates them at the same time. And, you know, for me, service is a very kind of isolating role. You know, you only get called upon when things go wrong, ultimately. So, you know, I've spent my time stuck on a machine at 7:30 at night, nowhere to turn. You know, I've been in that broom cupboard where there isn't room to swing a cat trying to fix a piece of equipment. So I know what that feels like. And I've been on the end of a phone call with my manager pleading at me saying, you know, please, can you get an extra call in? We're really busy. So I guess I felt all of those kind of frustrations, the highs and lows of being a service engineer. But, you know, I think more importantly, Chris, it taught me that, you know, I learned as an engineer how I want to be treated as a service engineer by my manager. And I've tried to weave that experience into how I manage engineers going forward. So I hope so. I certainly think that, you know, being on the tools and coming up through the ranks, as it were, certainly gives you a really good understanding of what happens to an everyday engineer. And you try and, as I say, weave that into how you manage going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it makes absolute sense, and I've kind of taken similar routes in the past, so I know where you're coming from there. I mean, 30 years is a fair term of service, as it were, but you must have seen some massive changes in the industry from that point. I mean, from the technology point of view, what do you think has been the biggest game changer that the service industry has seen?
Yeah, I mean, there's been many advances in field service over the years. But I mean, I know it sounds a little bit cliche, but I think the recent changes in both cloud and mobile technologies, I think probably going to have the biggest impact if they are not doing already. So when I think about it, you know, I look at engineers now, the ability to have an always-on device that gives them access to an unprecedented set of data, you know, parts manuals, technical bulletins, driving directions, customer entitlement, social media channels, FaceTime for technical support. I mean, the list is just endless. Yeah. So, you know, when I look at that, engineers, the ability to now get information from the systems they have to cross-sell and upsell, get into marketing databases to update what's happening in a customer site, looking at customer buying patterns. I mean, for me today, the engineer of today is extremely hooked up and immensely powerful part of any organization. And I think, you know, that for me is the biggest change. I think companies are starting to recognize that their service engineers have that trusted advisor status, and their power is absolutely immense. So I think for me that would be it.
It's that realization that these guys they've got all of the tools to hand, and like a trusted advisor, perfect phrase. You know, they're interacting directly with the customer. It's
absolutely
an incredibly powerful position. What about the customers in that period? And have you seen their needs change over time as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think about my own personal situation these days. You know, you think when you go on holiday and you're looking for a hotel to stay in. These days, you can just go online and pick 500 or 600 different people who stayed at the hotel who kind of, you know, will give you a view on how that hotel is actually performing.
Yeah.
I mean, but you couldn't do those things years ago. And I think in the same way, if you look in the B2B market, customers are incredibly savvy these days.
Yes.
And I think their demands are increasing. And I think certain service organizations are reacting to that, but not all. So, you know, when you think about that whole social media thing, they can decide in an instant whether they want to do business with your company. And service organizations, you know, they've got to make the customer interaction as seamless as possible. I think customers are demanding the ability, to expect the very best from a service organization.
Mm.
They want to place calls, you know, online. They want to track calls online. They want a service call when it suits them, not when it suits the service company. I think they look at companies like Amazon and want to understand why interactions with service companies can't be as slick as that.
Yeah.
So I think, frankly speaking, service organizations really need to shape up because there's no hiding place anymore. Customers can see everything and they have that kind of knowledge really at their fingertips these days, and that's putting a lot of pressure on service organizations.
Yeah, definitely, and it seeps into our everyday lives, so we just expect it everywhere now. And
absolutely.
Again, it's that element that service is so fundamental that, to be fair, the customers have the right to demand that if they're getting it from everywhere else in their lives. One question that I put in here, and I'm quite curious as to the answer to this, because I know you've been responsible for both UK teams and European-wide teams. Now, have there been any different challenges that appear in managing the mobile workforce in different nationalities and different cultures?
I don't believe there are huge differences. I think once you understand that you can't tar everyone with the same brush, and you do need to adapt. So an example of that is that, you know, you have to understand that changes take time to deliver in mainland Europe. You have to work with works councils and have a far more consultative approach. But I think if you embrace this and plan accordingly, the working relationships are strong in Europe, and the works councils and companies have built an understanding over the years. And it can work, I guess, to everybody's benefit. You know, language for me has always been the biggest issue.
Yeah.
Managing different mobile workforces, you know, we assume English is the international language of business. But, you know, we have to understand English is a second language for a lot of European-based service engineers.
Absolutely.
And in my experience, this is a big barrier. I've had many meetings with service guys who have nodded their head and said, oh, yes, we understand, but they don't quite. Having language translation services, you know, I had a guy who used to work for me who spoke fluent French, which helped me a lot.
Yeah.
In dealing with the French team. So, you know, there are also some regulatory environments you have to be careful of. You know, for instance, you can't track engineers in Germany, for instance.
Okay.
So you have to understand the cultural and legal differences. But I would say generally, no, I think it's reasonably straightforward if you take some of those situations I've just mentioned, into account.
Yeah, okay. It's interesting insights, particularly the not being able to track German engineers. Something that would never have crossed my mind at all. So, you know, it's good insight there. I'm going to take you back a step, because when you were talking us through your career, you mentioned that you had that first taste of moving to a profit centre. And obviously,
yeah.
It's the something that we're hearing an awful lot about, the move for service departments to move from cost centre to profit centre. Now, from your point of view, having been there, what's the best route that an organisation can take to achieve this?
Yeah, a tough one. I think there are two answers to this for me. It's a difficult transition, and I think companies need to invest in what I call blended skills of operational expertise. A lot of cost centres do excel in what I call this operational, expertise area.
Yeah.
But when it comes to commercial expertise, there's a struggle. You know, cost centre-centric methodology, they can spend far too much time understanding the cost of everything, but not the potential revenue and thus profitability of the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And often it can stare them in the face. So I think that's the first thing. So I think people need to, you know, companies need to train their people in P&L management, and they need to look at beefing up, for want of a better expression, their marketing efforts. Customers are looking for differentiated service offerings, and companies need to respect that and act upon it. And I think secondly to that, I talk to so many large companies, and I mean big, multinational, global companies,
yeah,
who are managing antiquated systems or on spreadsheets. And for me, it's a miracle how they do that, especially in this profit center environment.
Yeah,
so to manage a profit center, you have to have tight controls on revenue flows, product maintenance, inventory, order to cash, DSO, productivity, and so on. And you also need to drive revenue growth. So, you know, by managing upsell and cross-sell opportunities, you can only do that through an integrated service system, in my view. So companies making the transition really need to focus on a system that will deliver all of those things, and understand in some cases their old systems are not up to the job, and they need to invest. And, you know, I think that's a theme I'm hearing a lot. You know, we go into companies that haven't made investments in their service systems for 15 or 20 years.
Wow.
Yet the CEOs are demanding that they move to its profit-centered culture and drive additional revenue, and it's not always easy. So I think those are the two key things for me, Chris.
Okay. To try and make that transition when, you know, like I say, working on, you know, spreadsheets or systems that are 15, 20 years old.
Yeah, impossible.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is impossible.
When you were with Pitney Bowes, you implemented a cloud-based system, if I'm right. Now, what was the key considerations that you went through when you chose to opt for cloud rather than going for on-premise?
Yeah, well, obviously what I was looking for was a very flexible system, something that could grow with the organization, and as the organization changed and we diversified.
Yeah.
I mean, our sales team were already on Salesforce.com,
okay,
so that was an important consideration for us, because we saw that cloud was now trusted technology. And we needed to reduce the burden on our IT organization from an on-premise solution to a cloud-based solution, because, you know, they were under pressure from a cost perspective as well. And particularly for me, I needed a flexible reporting and analytics capability. You know, one of the frustrations I had with our previous system was that, we knew we were putting the data in, we just couldn't get the data out, or it was very expensive to run reports to do so. And, you know, I guess ultimately it needed to be scalable, and that's the beauty of cloud, scalable for global use. I think our previous system was geared towards the contact center, but it didn't cater for the service organizations. You know, I see that a lot these days. A lot of organizations invest in their contact centers, and almost service is seen as a bolt-on, for want of a better expression.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, a cloud-based solution was a perfect fit, particularly those that specialize in service organization solutions. I needed something where we could make changes quickly,
mm-hmm,
and also I wanted to be involved in an organization where we could influence their roadmap of the product. Because, you know, the great thing is, if you go into a cloud-based solution, there's two or three releases a year, you can start influencing the organization you choose in terms of what goes into those roadmap items.
Okay.
And obviously you want to do that benefits your organization.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, you're constantly updating and future-proofing the solution. When you go to an on-premise solution, it may be suitable for 2-3 years. But as your business starts to change, you need to make significant changes to your system. It becomes cumbersome and very, very expensive. So I wanted something that was quick and agile, and as I say, where we could influence the roadmap. And for me, those were some of the key considerations that we put in when we chose the new system.
Sure. Agile, I think, is probably the word that leapt out there from what you were saying. It's the fact that essentially the system could grow with you.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, if we wanted to make changes, you can literally make changes on the fly And you can do them a lot of cases. We're not necessarily using the IT function to do them if you choose the right partner. So I think having that on board as your organization continues to morph when you go after new types of business, then you need something where you can change your IT system quickly to cope with the demands of the business. And I think that made the big difference for us in terms of our decision.
Okay. Obviously, cloud's a relatively young technology. Let's look at the hardware side of things. I say relatively young, we're so used to them now, but tablets and smartphones are de rigueur in field service. Do you think that there's still a place for the older tech, the more rugged handheld computers or the PDAs anymore, or do you think you'll see essentially everyone moving across to, smartphone devices, whether it's BYOD or provided by the service company?
I guess yes and no. I think for simple implementations, a PDA may suffice.
Yeah.
But, for me, it's very limited in terms of what it can do. And I think anybody that invests in those, unless it's a very simple application, it may be a short-sighted investment. As for PCs, there's still a limited life in those, particularly, if you look at the shortcomings of the PC, it's not an always-on device. It has limited battery time. The boot-up times tend to be, excessive. Yeah. By the time you've connected to a VPN, it's very frustrating for engineers to use those. However, often the serial ports are utilized for data downloads from, large pieces of equipment for diagnostic purposes. So they, they're still out there and they still need to be supported. I think, with machine-to-machine technology coming through now, I think, the ability to be able to data download physically will start to diminish as end-to-end becomes more prevalent in service organizations. So, but I think it's a way off before that handles. There may be a Windows Smart tablet that may be a hybrid for both, and that could be something that may hit the marketplace sooner than later. But, for me personally, when we moved to the new service system, we went for iPad. They're so data rich in terms of content. If you think about the user experience, it's immense. And you can display a plethora of opportunities for a service company to really drive changes in engineers, both their mindsets, their working patterns, and so on. So I think an always-on device means that companies can interact with their engineers real-time during any shift times. And for me, therein lies the biggest opportunity. I cannot stress enough, if companies tap into this resource, there is a tremendous revenue-generating opportunity when you can present lots of rich data to a service engineer so they make informed decisions. Things like, being able to get a customer to sign a new service contract. That kind of technology is available now on tablets.
Yeah.
And I think companies are starting to recognize that and see that there really is a wealth of opportunity for them if they grab it.
Quick kind of point on the fact that you chose iPads. It was the fact that essentially these devices are so familiar to us in our daily lives away from the workplace. Is that familiarity lend itself to your decision making as well?
That's a really, really good point. One of the things we did with the service engineers, we were breaking over 200 PDAs per annum when we used to use PDAs. And, the breakages on iPad have been absolutely negligible, perhaps one or two in total in sort of 1,000 that we've now put across Europe. And I went out with an engineer for the day and said, I'm just really interested. We kind of budgeted that we would break more of these things.
Yes.
Why do you think they're not breaking? And the engineer turned around to me and he said, one of the things that you guys did was allowed us to use this device personally as well as for business. So he said, if I go home and my iPad's broken, he said, my kids would kill me. Because at the moment, they've got Angry Birds and Facebook and Twitter and they're FaceTiming and so on. He said, my kids use this as much as I do. So it's not just a business tool, it's a personal tool. And therefore, to me, it's something that I treasure and I look after. And that was I'd like to say that was an inspired decision that we made as an organization.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't take the credit for it, but I'm awfully glad we do. And now I advise companies who are looking at new service systems, if they're choosing iPad, I say to them, let the engineers use this thing personally because you won't regret it.
It's a really interesting insight. Just giving the engineers that little bit of ownership you know, gives them that 10 times more pride in, it's a really good insight into human nature amongst everything else. Now, looking at the ServiceMax solution, because obviously that's your current role, one of the things I'm curious about is the development of service management software. And I'm looking at optimized scheduling and seeing so many people now are kind of including scheduling, whereas even just a few years ago, it was kind of almost a specialist edition. I mean, do you think that scheduling should now be included in a service management software package as a standard? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of customers I interact with are all saying, oh, we absolutely need optimized scheduling.
Yeah.
And I understand why they think that. And it can drive significant business benefits. But, you know, for me, it isn't the holy grail, as it were. And a lot of companies think it is.
Yeah.
You need to think long and hard about optimization. So, yeah, in certain environments, I think it's critical, but not always. So, you know, if you're in a specialized business and productivity is low anyway, then no amount of optimization is really going to give you a huge benefit to your organization. But if productivity is high anyway, if you're perhaps driving 4, 5, 6 visits a day from your service technicians, then, yeah, optimizing can make perfect sense.
Yeah.
So I think some companies still want the ultimate say in dispatch, so maybe a hybrid model is better. And we're seeing more and more companies that almost want a semi-automated way. In other words, I still want to use dispatchers, but I want the system to suggest what the dispatcher should do next. So it kind of leads them to you know, here's my ideas,
yeah.
But the dispatcher makes the ultimate decision. So I think that is important. But I think there are two considerations companies really need to think of. The first one for me, and I hear this a lot, is what I call the customer and engineer impact. So optimization can impact on the relationships engineers have with their customers. You know, if you move from a system of engineers self-scheduling themselves and working the patch to automatic scheduling where they only get one call at a time, and any number of those engineers can attend that call, and this can have quite a dramatic effect on customers and employee satisfaction. And we hear customers that have implemented optimization have seen a decline in both you know, customer satisfaction and also employee satisfaction as well. So a lot of companies that have done it haven't regretted doing it, but I think they've underestimated the impact on both the customer and the employee. You know, take a typical service engineer. It may well be for very good reasons that the engineer, you know, drops his kids off at school in the morning, but he makes the time up elsewhere. You know, in an old system where he managed his own patch, he could manage his kind of day accordingly. But of course, when you just drip feed them one call at a time, that goes out of the window. And as I say, it can have a dramatic effect. So I've seen a lot of companies implement and then kind of backtrack a little bit and then understand the kind of social impacts of what they're doing, and then rolling out again in a kind of perhaps more gentle way. So I think that's the first thing. And secondly, I think it's great to squeeze an extra call out of an engineer with optimization, but I think you need to think about the wider picture. It's great having an engineer perhaps do an extra call a day, but it's no good if the engineer that turns up to that call doesn't have the right skills, he doesn't have the right part, he's no access to technical support diagrams or a knowledge base. You know, he needs the ability to send parts back and so on. So, you know, even the ability to communicate through social channels, all of those things need to be in consideration when you choose a solution provider. So optimization for me is just one of the spokes in the wheel, but there are other spokes in the wheel for a great service solution, and I think people really need to consider that.
Yeah, it's there's a fundamental fact of the service industries is that, you know, it's a people-led industry, whether it's from, you know, the field engineering, you mentioned a couple of scenarios there, but actually, you know, the point that you made about the customer satisfaction diminishing, you know, that's again something that perhaps some people don't, they just see the numbers rather than seeing the actual facts, but there could be a strong, healthy relationship that's developed across, you know, a number of years between a service engineer and his client base, and that's something I think is very worth highlighting.
I think it's a very, very important point, Chris, because, you know, as you say, a lot of times a service engineer has been servicing the need of a client for many, many years.
Yeah.
And, of course, in an optimized environment, the customer maybe previously used to call the engineer directly.
Yes.
And say, you know, I'm in big trouble. Is there any chance you can make it to me today? And, you know, service engineers, you know, can have the ability to try and alter their route, as it were, and try and see if they can help that customer. Of course, when you're in the contact center now, they just get given the standard answer. You know, the computer says it won't be tomorrow until 2:30 before the guy can get with you, because you know, that's what an optimized scheduling system does. So I'm not saying it doesn't work. It definitely has benefits in organizations, absolutely. But it's just one consideration, I think, when choosing a solution provider.
Okay. Let's have a look at the future. Now, we talked a lot about the past and, you know, your experience in the past. But what do you think the future holds for field service industries? You know, are we going to see field service technicians driving around with 3D printers in the back of their vans printing off parts? And are we going to see unmanned aerial drones buzzing around our heads, dropping off packages from Amazon and the like? What's your future hold?
I put my future spectacles on. You know, last week I read an article about, I don't know if you saw it yourself, Chris, about British Aerospace making parts for a tornado fighter.
Yes.
Using 3D printed parts, which just blew me away. You think, crikey, if it can fit for a fighter aircraft, then why not?
Well, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people have told me 5 years ago even that, you know, the engineers today could FaceTime each other for technical support, or, you know, they could search local inventory of engineers within a 20-mile radius to see if they had the part that they needed.
Yeah.
That they could upsell and cross-sell. They can get customers to sign there and then on their tap. You know, I'd have just said, hey, you were crazy. But, you know, all of those things are now a reality. So bottom line to me is, yeah, I really could. I can see delivery drones. I can see engineers, you know, ordering parts and making their own parts as a reality. I think it's going to be here sooner than we think. For me, the big question is, which company is looking to the future, predicting those changes and thus planning for it? You know, I think that's the biggest question here. Companies really need to think about where these future technologies are taking us and plan accordingly. And I guess that for me is absolutely the crux.
Yeah, definitely. And it's an exciting future. We covered a couple of pieces recently in Field Service News looking at various future technologies. It does feel at times that we're living in on the set of Star Trek or something with all the different questions.
It absolutely does. I mean, you know, it's amazing these days where an engineer can pick his tablet up,
yeah,
call another engineer on FaceTime, and, you know, actually show them video live of what's going wrong with a piece of equipment. I mean, it's just immense. You know, think about your technical support. Think about times where engineers are stuck out there on their own with no help around them, or they thought there's no help. Not, you know, perhaps fresh off a training course now. I mean, just the technology that's available is mind-blowing, and it is changing service organizations immensely.
And, of course, you know, there's wearable technology is the big push for the year as well. I mean, crikey, you know, the technology is almost there already with Google Glass. For the engineer to literally be able to look at a machine, if you combine that with machine-to-machine or something else,
that
could be 2 years away from actually seeing the existing travel. Anyway, I'll stop talking about that because I get very excited. The industry itself has obviously kind of gone through quite an up and down period since the big economic meltdown. I mean, it seems like a long time ago now, but do you think that the pressure on service companies has increased since post 2008?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, CEOs have seen their top line from equipment sales perspective slow down during, you know, this sustained economic, let's be kind and call it a downturn. And I think they're now looking at all of their P&L lines, and they're looking at their service organization and saying, well, hang on a minute, it hasn't had all the focus. You know, we should use this as a revenue growth engine. And, you know, I say that that's put service leaders into the spotlight, as it were, and as such created a problem, but also an opportunity, depending on your point of view. I think the problem now is that service leaders have demands placed on them, and they don't necessarily have all the answers, but an opportunity for long-awaited investment in new systems and technology, I think, will obviously help them move their organization forward. You know, they're exciting times for service departments and service leaders. If they grasp the opportunity, they can get the investment that they've been looking for a long time and really start to drive their service organizations on. So, yeah, yes, the economic downturn has been tough, but I think for service organizations, they have a chance from going what I call from the spotlight into the limelight by driving additional revenue and thus profitability for their organizations.
Yes. As with any challenge, there will be companies that tuck themselves in and try and ride it out, and then there's the leaders, as you say, the push themselves forward and take the opportunity.
Absolutely.
There is a phenomenal amount of opportunity at the moment. I mean, talking of challenges, what was the greatest challenge you ever faced in your time as a service manager director?
Oh, I've had so many. I think at all different levels. I think very early on in my career, I remember when I worked in OSE in 1996, the regional sales manager came rushing into my office one day and announced we'd won a massive deal with over 1,000 machines, and we were delighted, obviously, as an organisation. Yeah. So I started out congratulating him. Great job for you and your team. And he said, yeah, the only problem is, he said, we need to deliver and install those 1,000 machines in 10 weeks. And we've got to do 32 locations in the UK.
Wow.
So I remember sitting back in the chair and I said, well, I wish the person doing that the very best of luck. You know where this is going, don't you?
Yeah.
To which he replied, well, I've recommended you to manage the project, he said. In 2 days, you're presenting to the UK board on how we're going to do this. Now, just to put that in context, the last major implementation we'd done took over 9 months.
Ooh,
so
goodness.
I remember having two very sleepless nights, but I revamped the whole delivery methodology of the organisation. We devised forward staging posts. We pre-installed our products. And we actually did it. We did 1,000 machines in 9.5 weeks with only 8 engineers. So that was exhausting, but well worthwhile. It taught me a lot, certainly.
Yeah.
But I guess that was early on in my career. I think more recently, the rollout of ServiceMax was very challenging. Pitney Bowes is a business made up of over 80 acquisitions. So understanding all the needs of all the different businesses across Europe was extremely challenging. Meeting the deadlines as well and recognizing the business case was a tall order, but we made it. So I learned an awful lot, and I now use that experience of implementing ServiceMax as well as my kind of 25 years plus in service to hopefully advise other companies looking to adopt to a cloud-based solution. So I guess if I look at that kind of history, it really helps me with my current role.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, also looking at your current role, ServiceMax, obviously, you've got quite a unique perspective, having been the client and now being with the organisation themselves and advising other service companies on their solutions. What is it that separates ServiceMax for you, or that separates them from other providers in the market?
Yeah, I would say probably, I guess, 4 things come to mind. If you think about our solution, we sit on a Salesforce.com platform, and we are end-to-end solution. So we're the only company in the industry right now that has a full end-to-end suite sat on the native Force.com platform, and I think that's an important distinction over any of our competitors. I think secondly, I mentioned before, we've done over 300 implementations now, and those range from, small and medium enterprises to multi-billion dollar companies, like GE, Coca-Cola and Tyco, they're all our customers. So I think now we can advise companies on best practice to make sure they maximize their investment and obviously gain the returns that they're looking for. I think the third thing is that service is in our blood. It's what we do. So I'll give you an example of that.
Okay.
In 2013, our CEO mandated that every person working in ServiceMax went on what we call, it's a very American term here, a ride-along. And that means they go out for a service engineer for the day.
Yeah.
So now if you think about it, this is the person greeting the guest in our building to the vice president of marketing did one, or somebody in accounts payable right through to our CEO. And in fact, our CEO did 3 ride-alongs himself. And, we thought we understood field service. No. It's only when you go out with a service engineer for a day and you see what those guys through. So we learned so much and got such a rich and deep understanding of what happens in the day of a life of the service engineer.
Mm.
So all of those ride-along changes, they were documented. We put them all on our what we call chatter, which is, if you like, our social channel within the organization.
Yeah.
And they're all documented. And that we're now driving changes in our product from what we learned from those ride-alongs.
Excellent.
And they're not just a flash in the pan. The CEO is determined that every year, at least everybody has to do at least 1 ride-along with a service engineer.
Excellent.
And I think that's great. And I think the fourth one is we've kind of taken our combined experience and we're now designing what we call the ServiceMax Field Service University.
Okay.
So everybody in ServiceMax has to attend the Field Service University, and depending on your role in the organization, up to 5 days of certified training, and each year there'll be refresher courses. So
yeah.
I think for me that sums up the service organization. Service is in our DNA.
Yeah.
So we're not a software company with a service product. For me, we're a service company with a software product, and that differentiates us as far as I'm concerned.
It's a big distinction as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about these ride-alongs, because I've got a question here that I always see as one of the issues of, engaging with the field engineer. So perhaps you had this feedback when the ride-alongs were coming along. But as we can track and monitor every single element of a field services, field service engineer's activity throughout the day, there's always that worry that some engineers, even some workforces, may resent this kind of big brother outlook.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm going to ask you this from two points. How do you overcome this from as a service manager, from your experience as a service manager, and also then, what else can be done in terms of, from the technology point of view, in making sure the engineers are seeing the investment in the technology as a benefit for them?
Yeah, I think I mentioned before about allowing to use the technology personally, I think is a big thing. And something we're developing as an organization now is this term gamification. Yeah. So we're now trying to utilize the tool for engineers to be more engaged in terms of what they do. But, I take your point. I think it can be construed as a risk. But I think if companies roll out this kind of technology and they have a problem where people think there's a kind of big brother mentality, that I think they perhaps need to look at how they're engaging their workforce in the solution in the first place.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned before, in Pitney Bowes we use the iPad, and I think that's a great way of engaging them. And as I say, we allow them to use it personally. And that did give us a great deal of buy-in, I have to say. Some may argue Big Brother was watching them, but I think if you show them, explain the business case to them and how we want to, this is about growing your organization. This is about utilizing the power of those trusted advisors. It's about giving them more information at their fingertips. It's about making them feel completely empowered as a service technician. I think if you explain all those benefits to them, it's not about tracking them and finding out where they are or whether they got to their first call at 9 o'clock. We all expect engineers, this is a flexible role that they have.
Yeah.
Sometimes they get to the first call late because of traffic or whatever. Sometimes they work late. Those are the swings and roundabouts that happen in most service organizations. So it's not there to catch people out. It's about empowering service engineers. And I think if you get that message across and you do it in a way that technicians understand and they understand how you built your business case behind it, I think they will get it. So for me, it's all about education to stop people feeling that way. And, I always say to engineers, at the end of the day, if you go out there and you do your job, you've nothing to fear. So this technology is not
absolutely
there to catch you out. It's there to help you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, from Big Brother then to Big Data. Another technology that we managed to overlook when we were discussing the future a wee bit earlier, perhaps because it's here. It's not the future, it's here. We keep hearing about it. Do you think it's going to be long before we start seeing true big data applications introduced into field service software?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I saw a great quote a few days ago. I don't know if you've seen it yourself. It says, big data is like teenage sex. Everyone talks about it. Nobody really knows how to do it. And everybody thinks everybody else is doing it. So everybody claims they're doing it. And, that kind of, I think that summed it up for me.
So, spot on.
My translation to this to field services is a simplified one. Organizations have more and more data coming in than ever before.
Yeah.
And if you can determine how to process that data in a way that makes it, consumable, so you can use it, effectively in your organization, then you leverage it to make more informed business decisions. So I guess in answer to your question, big data is already, for me, playing a part in field service. When I go around and talk to service leaders, and it's one of the common things I hear more than anything else. They know to put the data in, but they just can't get the data out in a usable format that benefits them.
Yeah.
And visibility of their data is like the number one thing hampering their field service organization. So, it might seem like a shameless plug, forgive me if I do, but, one of the things that I looked at with ServiceMax was the reporting. And, to get access to dashboards and reports real time, that gives any service a business for me a competitive edge.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think the ability to measure and then manage a problem, the old adage, you can't manage what you don't measure.
Yes.
Doing that on spreadsheets, with the more and more data that people get, it's just becoming completely unwieldy. It's just totally cumbersome. So, one of the things we've just done is just hired product managers exclusively focused on translating and making sense of the tons of bits of service data that comes in from the field. So the idea is that we want to be able to put data in a way to executives to help them make informed decisions. So, you know, we're now looking at things like predictive analytics. Yeah. So it's not about telling you all of the things that are going on in your service organization. It's more about telling you the changes within your service organization. You know, it's that little red warning light that comes on your dashboard in your car to say, hey, if you don't do something about this, this could give you a problem. Yeah. You know, this very expensive part is now being consumed 3 times faster than its normal consumption rate. Those are the kind of information. So taking all of that kind of big data of information and breaking it down into the usable chunks that makes sense for a service leader. So I don't think big data is something new. Mm-hmm. It's been around a long time, but I guess we're trying, as an organization, we're trying to find ways of making actionable sense of it so that service leaders can then act upon it and drive, you know, real focus, operational efficiencies and revenue growth into their organization.
Excellent. Okay. Looking at the choice, looking at the decision-making process, and again, I'd like to pick your brain on the dual side from the experience most recently with Pitney Bowes and then through to your current role now as Vice President of ServiceMax. What's the decision-making process when selecting a new service management solution? Who should be involved in that decision? What's the key to getting that right?
Yeah, well, the CFO certainly. I mean, that for me is the number one stop. You've got to get the finances right for any service system. It's got to make financial sense. So getting the buy-in of the CFO was certainly something I did very early on when I was selecting a vendor. Obviously, the CIO needs to be involved because particularly if you're moving to cloud, yeah. Then there's an impact on the IT organization. Obviously, the CSO, the Chief Service Officer or Service Director needs to be involved. I think the big one for me is the sales VP, because I think if you get this thing right, you need to integrate with your sales organization. Now, you know, we were blessed because our sales organization were on Salesforce.com. So we tried to build interfaces between a ServiceMax solution and Salesforce so we could get things like sales leads from the service engineers and drive value for the organization. So I think you've really got to spend time with the sales VP, showing what you're trying to achieve as an organization, and I think if you get their buy-in, it can really help you a lot with the business case. I think from a selection of a vendor, you need to look at the processes that the service organization touches, such as, you know, supply chain, customer contact center, and so on. Those are important. But for me, the most important is get the people who are going to use it involved in it. You know, get the call center agents and the service engineers. You know, we talked before about this kind of big brother attitude. Well, you know, get them involved in the selection process.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really important. Let them see the benefits of the system and let them feel part and parcel of the solution design. And I think if you get them involved from a decision perspective, you know, word spreads fast throughout the service engineering community that they've been involved in the decision, they like what the vendor's got to offer, and they think it'll add a real difference to the organization.
It's that empowerment again, isn't it?
You know, absolutely, yeah.
It's kind of giving them that ownership is the word that keeps coming into my head, you know. I think that's a fantastic suggestion. Okay, let's look at one last question to round things off. What developments can we expect from ServiceMax in the next year or so?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at a slide the other day looking at the development of the product over the last 5 years. It's pretty staggering, to be honest, but I would suggest probably 2 main areas that I think that we'll focus on. Number one is mobility, for obvious reasons. You know, we're expanding our mobile offerings, and that's a huge focus for us this year. So we already work on most mobile devices, but we're going to really build out our offerings for a mobile interface on all devices. So it's a big priority for us to keep up the mobile offerings to make sure, you know, we have the latest and intuitive design and have the functionality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, last year we hired a user experience and a user interface expert in our organization, and we want to deliver a fantastic user experience. So we're going to see some pretty amazing stuff from ServiceMax this year. We've showed our customers already, you know, we have customer advisory boards and user groups. We've already showed them some of the developments that are coming down the path, and we've had an overwhelming response to some of the new things that we're suggesting. So the customers seem pretty excited about that.
Excellent.
And I think secondly, I touched on this point earlier on, but for me, this is data. You know, I'm really enthused about what's coming down the line with reporting and analytics. You know, I've been in service a long time, and I don't think I've ever seen anything as powerful as what we're now working on for a service leader. So So we're going to be able to, you know, roll this out to our customers probably later on this year.
Okay.
So we're talking about real-time reporting insights that are tuned to your, you know, you as a person, what you want to see in your business. You know, and for every service leader, that's different. You know, I used to look at 8 dashboards when I worked at Pitney Bowes. There were 8 things that I spent a long time concentrating on as a service leader to make sure that I was driving the organization to deliver the numbers I had to do. But underneath me were a series of direct reports who all had their own dashboards and reports that they were working on to drive those key 8 things to me. And it's great to see that sort of top-to-toe synergy within your organization from a data and reporting perspective. So it's a very, very powerful piece for us. So I know people have probably heard it before, and I have too, but this, for me, this is the real deal. This really turns your field service organization into a living, breathing, more profitable organization. So, you know, I think mobile and data are absolutely key, and that's what we'll be concentrating on as an organization this year.
Excellent. Well, all sounds very exciting, and we look forward to seeing those developments a little bit later on in the year. Well, that brings us to the end. Sadly, we've run out of time once again for this month's podcast, but just to take the opportunity to say thank you very much, David, for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and some really great insight. And we'll be back with another podcast within the month. Cheers, then.